An audacious hijacking over the skies of Belarus. A plane is detoured and a dissident detained by Belarusian strongman Alexander Lukashenko.
Lukashenko is a very revengeful person, and he has been well known for taking revenge against his opponents.
Also ahead, prison reform advocates say county jails should not detain undocumented immigrants. Local battles with national aspirations.
To signal to the federal government, hey, actually, this is not okay and this shouldn't be happening.
And remembering a Chinese scientist who helped feed the world by creating a better strain of rice.
You know, for half the people on Earth, rice is their main staple. And he helped bring these high-yield strains of rice to Nigeria, Pakistan, Vietnam, India.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Okay, here's the scene. A flight is heading from Athens to Lithuania. Flying over Belarus, the pilots get notification of a bomb threat. A fighter jet forces the plane to land. A couple of passengers are then detained by Belarusian authorities. This isn't a plot point in an action film, and there was no bomb. Yesterday, Ryanair Flight 4978 was intercepted, and one of the people detained was 26-year-old Belarusian dissident Roman Protasevich. The operation was reportedly approved by Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko, a man referred to as Europe's last dictator. Joining me now is Katya Glad. She's a Belarus analyst with SEPA, the Center for European Policy Analysis, and she joins us from London. Katya, first of all, who is Roman Protasevich?
Roman Protasevich is a Belarusian journalist and a famous blogger. Roman is the founder of a very popular Telegram channel, which is called Nekhte, which was behind mass protests in Belarus, which erupted last August. And Roman Protasevich, at the time, he was part of this Nekhte team. Nowadays, he is the editor of another very popular Telegram channel in Belarus called The Brain of Belarus, which has several hundred thousand subscribers, and is also very widely read in Belarus.
So why did Alexander Lukashenko approve this brazen operation?
Well, first of all, we have to realize that Lukashenko is a very revengeful person. He has been well known for taking revenge against his opponents. And Nekhte obviously displayed Lukashenko and the regime, the security services, to a great extent, because as I've just said, they mobilized people, they organized protests. Another reason is an attack on mass media, which we have seen in Belarus basically since last summer.
So now that Protasevich is in Belarusian custody, what is likely to happen to him?
Well, he's likely to face up to 15 years in prison. The likely charges are to be organizing public disorder and also stoking social strife. So that means that he's currently somewhere at the KGB prison or at one of the detention facilities in Minsk. We know that his girlfriend was transported to one of the detention facilities in Minsk, the so-called Akrestina prison, which became very infamous during the August protest, because this is where tortures and beatings of many protesters happened.
You mentioned the mass protests against Lukashenko last summer. They were followed by a harsh government crackdown that continues to this day. Does this arrest change anything for Belarusians who oppose Lukashenko?
Unfortunately, it does not change much for Belarusians inside Belarus. Is that perhaps more people will be thinking about immigrating and leaving the country. Obviously, creates another international precedent. It puts the Belarusian regime onto a new level of priority. If, for example, we can say that before, Belarus has been more of a moral issue, moral dilemma, particularly for the European Union. It was not nice that human rights have been abused in Belarus or that elections were rigged, but it has not really until now affected directly the rights of European citizens. Yesterday's incident has shown that now Lukashenko's regime became a real threat to international norms, a real threat to the European security. And Belarusians inside Belarus do hope that the West could take tougher sanctions against the regime.
It's interesting. I mean, President Lukashenko had to know that the world would harshly condemn him for doing this. And he knew of this and he did it anyway. What does that tell you?
Well, it tells us that the regime has lost control of political thinking, that the regime is really waging a war because its goal only to stay in power, regardless by which means. It tells us that the regime is not prepared to negotiate with the opposition or with the West, and that it's not backing off.
What role might Russia have here? I mean, do you think Russian government officials were in the loop on this?
We do know that there were actually four people who did not board the flight back to Vilnius. And apart from Roman Protasevich and his girlfriend, there were two Russian citizens. And the speculation is that either they were Belarusian KGB or that they were Russian FSB agents, and perhaps that Russia lended a helping hand to Belarus. Well, either way, Russia would not be the country that would try to punish Belarus or would try to tell it that that's not the right way forward.
How do you think the United States should respond to this event?
So far, we have seen only a statement of Mr. Blinken, who obviously condemned the situation and said that there should be given an adequate response. I think it will be a real test to the unity between the U.S. and the European Union, whether the U.S. will join the European Union in offering a very tough stance against this behavior of the Belarus regime.
Katia Galaud is a Belarus analyst with the Center for European Policy Analysis. She's been talking to us about the interception of Ryanair Flight 4978 and the arrest of Belarusian dissident Roman Protasevich. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This evening in Belarus, a new video was released of Roman Protasevich after his arrest. It was posted on a pro-government Belarusian channel. Protasevich says he is in good health and is being treated well, possibly under duress. He also confesses to plotting riots in Minsk, crimes that carry a 15-year penalty. His forehead also appears bruised in the video. So what happens next? The European Union has found itself at the center of this situation. Ryanair is headquartered in Ireland. The plane was registered in Poland. The flight was going from Greece to Lithuania. Today, heads of EU states are meeting to discuss potential sanctions. The World's Lydia Amatalidou reports from Athens, where Flight 4978 departed.
Reaction from EU leaders has been swift and strongly worded. Yesterday, in a tweet, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen called the diversion of the Ryanair flight a hijacking and illegal. In a statement today, EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell said the diversion of the flight was a blatant attempt by Belarusian authorities to silence opposition. And he called for the immediate release of journalist and activist Roman Protasevich. Other EU leaders, past and present, called the whole thing unacceptable, unprecedented, abhorrent, shocking, and
outrageous.
Tomas Hendrik Ilves is the former president of Estonia. He says whatever word you want to use to describe it, this incident has put the EU on high alert, and for good reason.
Basically, it calls into question any flights over Belarus to begin with.
And he says the technique that Belarusian authorities used to force the plane to land sets a dangerous precedent.
Many people fear it might be used by other totalitarian and authoritarian regimes. So it must be met with a strong response.
Belarus claims that what it did was legal. John Wirth disagrees. He's an expert on EU transport laws and teaches at the College of Europe in Belgium. He says what happened was a violation of international aviation rules that govern civilian air traffic.
We have to treat this as a very unprecedented situation and an unprecedented escalation of the political tensions that there are in Belarus.
He says the UN's International Civil Aviation Authority will now investigate the incident, but the agency has no regulatory power. So it'll be up to member states to decide what consequences Belarusian President Lukashenko and his regime should face. The EU has promised those consequences are coming.
I think we really must let him have it.
Radek Sikorski is a member of the European Parliament from Poland. He used to be the country's foreign and defense minister.
Mr. Lukashenko is the definition of a tin-horn dictator. And if we can't deter him, who do we have any hope of deterring?
He wants the EU to ban the state-owned Belarusian airline from EU airspace. EU leaders are also considering suspending all EU flights from going over Belarus. A couple airliners, including Wizz Air and Air Baltic, have already said they'll do that. The EU is also considering doubling down on other sanctions it's imposed against top Belarusian officials. They include travel bans and asset freezes. Sikorsky also wants an investigation into Russia's potential involvement here.
Because there are some reports indicating that those that boarded the plane who helped to engineer this coup had Russian passports. And if that were the case, then we need to sanction Russian KGB personnel and Russia itself.
But of course, the question is, what is the objective of this kind of actions?
Katarzyna Zisk is a professor of international relations at the Norwegian Institute for Defense Studies.
And I think the first objective should be to deter from similar actions taken by Belarus, but also by potential other countries in the future.
She says previous economic sanctions imposed by the EU clearly haven't deterred Lukashenko, and that a stronger response will require more coordination between the EU and NATO member states, including the US. But she says it'll be a balancing act. Sanctions could drive Belarus and Russia closer together and hurt the Belarusian people more than the regime. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
Now, for those of you who have never called Europe home, you may have missed the big news this weekend. The Italian group Måneskin took home the highly coveted first place award at the Eurovision Song Contest. Their winning song, Zitti e Buono, Shut Up and Be Quiet. Rock and roll is back. And big fashion. Måneskin wowed the audience and judges with their tight red leather jumpsuits with no shirts. Think 1980s glam rock with a 21st century Italian fashion twist. Among all the acts, there was plenty of big hair, sequin dresses, along with angel wings and fur on stage. You could call it a celebration of pre-pandemic life and what's to come. Here's one other twist on this year's contest. A lot of songs weren't sung in English. Most of the top entries were sung in the performer's native tongue. Here's the Ukrainian entry, Shum, by the band Go A. This took fifth place. Groovy stuff, but you know what? I'm done talking. Måneskin leader Damiano David gets the final word.
We just want to say to the whole Europe, to the whole world, rock and roll never dies!
Well, almost the final word. Play us to the break, Måneskin. Last week on the program, I spoke with Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert. Fauci told me that another pandemic is almost guaranteed, but that a pandemic preparedness plan is being fine-tuned ahead of time. Read more of what Fauci had to say in our conversation last week. Find that in our Top of the World newsletter. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. And you're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The top decision-making body for the World Health Organization is meeting this week, and the stakes couldn't be higher. Richer countries appear to have turned a corner on the pandemic, but much of the world continues to struggle. WHO Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus gave a blunt reality check at the opening session this morning.
There is no diplomatic way to say it. a small group of countries that make and buy the majority of the world's vaccines control the fate of the rest of the world.
The World's Alana Gordon is following the meeting. Alana, what's being discussed?
Well, a lot, Carol, is being discussed. Leaders are actually looking big picture at how to reform this global health system, including the WHO, to end the pandemic and also avert future ones. The meeting started today with statements from high-profile leaders like German Chancellor Angela Merkel. She said new diseases will emerge, and the priority must be to have a system with better alert and response capabilities.
How exactly do you do that?
There's a lot of different ideas circulating, but one of the biggest proposals is for nations to agree to a pandemic treaty. At least 25 heads of states have backed this idea, and that includes the UK, South Africa, Chile. And the idea is this would address problems having to do with sharing of data, pathogens, and even vaccines. And it could be a way to improve production of medicines, too, and strengthen WHO powers. The former Prime Minister of New Zealand, Helen Clark, she co-chaired a high-profile independent panel, and that group has been really pushing for a treaty to move forward ASAP, based on their assessments of what happened this past year.
The panel identified gaps and failures at every step of pandemic preparedness and response.
And so, Carol, for example, countries failed to act soon enough. The WHO was hindered in its investigations of the outbreak in China.
So a pandemic treaty, it sounds like a really powerful idea, but how do you actually make it happen?
I mean, this is where it gets tricky and tense, because for anything to happen, it has to go through this meeting. I talked with Obi Aginam about this process. He's a law professor at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. He's also been involved in treaty negotiations before. And basically, the 194 member states, they have to be on board.
There's no veto per se, but they always try to do things on consensus. And you can agree with me that it's very difficult, you know, to get consensus on every little, you know, thing.
Everyone has to agree to even draft a treaty and move that process forward. Right now, there's no actual treaty draft. And what's being proposed is to move forward to negotiate a treaty in the coming months. And so far, the U.S., as an example, doesn't appear to have signed on to negotiating right now.
What's the issue?
Well, one tension is, should the world put its energy and resources into drafting a treaty in this moment that's about the future, or focus on addressing the crisis at hand? And when you think about a treaty, whether that's climate change or nuclear arms, that requires domestic support, too. For a pandemic treaty, this may involve agreeing to outside investigators coming in. Low- and middle-income countries may also have reservations, like how can their participation really ensure access to medicines?
I mean, is there any precedent for this? I mean, has a treaty like this ever been done before?
So through the WHO, just once has this happened in its nearly 75 years of existence. It was for the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. It was adopted. It took years for this to happen, but countries are on board to help prevent the harms of smoke. But this time around with the pandemic treaty, many are skeptical about how soon anything could happen. Because again, with that earlier treaty, it took years to happen. Backers say this is different now. The coronavirus has shaken the world to its core, and it's global catastrophes like these that give rise to the openings that are needed for sweeping changes.
The World's Alana Gordon, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Carol.
A few months back, President Biden ordered changes to how the federal government contracts out with private prisons. The goal is to rethink a system that has disproportionately targeted people of color. It's not just private prisons. County jails often contract with the government to house undocumented immigrants. Last week, the Biden administration ended two contracts with county jails in Georgia and Massachusetts. The facilities are under federal investigation for allegations of abuse against immigrants in their custody. Advocates say that's a good start, but sweeping changes are still needed. The World's Daisy Contreras has more.
Several dozen people are in front of a county building in Woodstock, Illinois, a small city near Chicago.
This is not a local fight. This is a nationwide fight.
For far too long, they say, the county has worked with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, to detain undocumented immigrants. The county receives $95 a day from the federal government for each detainee in custody. Organizers want that partnership to end, following the footsteps of other local governments across the U.S. Last month, for example, a New Jersey county ended its ICE contract. Without any federal mandate to end immigration detention in county jails, advocates will look to local and state lawmakers to act, says Silky Shaw. She's with Detention Watch Network, a group advocating against immigration detention. And public pressure is increasing, she says.
It's so important whenever you have these fights at the local level to show the impact of detention in your community, to signal to the federal government, hey, actually, this is not okay and this shouldn't be happening.
It can be a tough sell, especially when these communities have depended on those federal dollars and the jobs that come with running detention centers. But the pandemic did shrink how many immigrants are being detained, and many people wonder whether the same amount of detention centers are necessary, Shaw says.
With COVID, there was a reduction in the number of people detained for a bunch of reasons, because the border was closed, because a lot of people were continuing to be deported, and less enforcement operations.
Still in Illinois, the McHenry County Board, where Woodstock is, voted last week to keep their county jail's partnership with ICE. The jail has beds for 250 immigrants, but during the pandemic, many of those went unused. It was a contentious debate. The majority of board members weren't convinced that ending the ICE contract would make a big difference.
And this county board doesn't have the ability to solve the immigration problem in this country. And that's why I'm not voting to eliminate the jail contract that we have with ICE.
While others were concerned about where the detainees would go if the contract ends.
To send those people someplace else. I will be voting no on this for that fact alone. The money is not the issue to me. I believe we can cut budgets, and we should cut budgets regardless.
But undocumented immigrants like Johannes Favi says this is a moral issue. He's an immigrant from Benin who spent close to a year detained at one of Illinois' county jails. He also wants to see ICE contracts end and detention altogether. He drove to Woodstock from his home in Indiana to speak at the meeting.
Well, I do that because for me, it's just common sense to fight for what is right. And I've lived it, so I know this is wrong. And if nobody stands to do something against it, well, it'll keep happening.
The outcome was disappointing, says Maria Valdez, another organizer. But it's important to keep the momentum going, she says. The movement in Woodstock captivated community members who had never been involved in organizing before, says Valdez.
A silver lining of this is that it mobilizes people, right? It makes people feel angry, more passionate and engaged to be able to push for something.
She's hopeful change will come. She and other organizers won more states to join the movement.
So is it a good time? It is always a good time to do the right thing. Are we going to win? I think that we have a good chance.
For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
This is The World. Satellite photos show evidence of what China is accused of doing in Xinjiang province, forcing Uyghurs and other ethnic minorities into re-education camps and prisons.
When some of these facilities stretch for as long as 3 kilometers, as the longest one does, that's essentially impossible to hide from the sky.
Documenting it from the ground is another story. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is expected to arrive in the Middle East tomorrow, Blinken's first trip to the region as the top U.S. diplomat. His visit comes on the heels of Friday's ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. Blinken will meet with Israeli, Palestinian, and other regional counterparts. Blinken said it's time to talk about rebuilding Gaza.
We have to deal with making this turn from the violence. We've got the ceasefire. And now deal with the humanitarian situation, deal with reconstruction, and deepen our existing engagement with Palestinians and with Israelis alike.
So what comes next? Joining me now is Ryan Boll. He's a senior analyst at the intelligence group Stratfor. Ryan, how does the Biden administration intend on rebuilding Gaza?
Well, the most direct and straightforward way will be to provide aid into the Gaza Strip for humanitarian projects, rebuilding destroyed infrastructure, rebuilding buildings that were targeted during this 11-day war. That's going to be the most immediate thing that they can do. But they have a complication with that aim. Even with that aim, the Israelis are already positioning themselves to try to use that aid, something as a political football against Hamas. They want to use that aid to leverage the extension of this ceasefire ceasefire from Hamas. That's something that they were doing already with international aid from 2017 onwards. But now with a greater reconstruction bill, they're hoping to use this as leverage over the militants. But the militants are threatening that if Israel does so, they'll resume rocket fire back into Israel and we could have another escalation ladder which sees us end up back into another war.
Now, there's another issue as well. President Biden has said he wants to rebuild Gaza without restocking Hamas. What does that mean?
Well, that means that they're trying to find ways to get aid to the Gaza Strip that goes to civilians and not to the militants. But that's very tricky. Hamas is a very resourceful organization. It takes things like tubes and civilian plumbing equipment and turns that into rockets. They are very low-tech, high-impact militant organization that has been able to take stuff that should just be for civilian use and make it into dual military use. That's what they're trying to find a way to ensure that that doesn't happen. But it's very tricky. There's no one on the ground within Gaza that has the power to stop Hamas from taking some of these materials and militarizing them. So that's one of the tricky parts that they're going to have to figure out. And that's what Israel is currently objecting to. That's what they're hoping, that if they can put themselves in between Hamas and this aid, they can convince Hamas that doing that sort of behavior isn't worth it.
As far as you know, does the Biden administration intend to work to lift the blockade over Gaza imposed by Israel and Egypt since 2007?
I think the Biden administration wants to create some more sustainable holes in the blockade for humanitarian aid that stabilizes Gaza's social situation and potentially undercuts Hamas's militant appeal amongst ordinary Palestinians. But they're going to run up against Israeli objections to that. As for lifting the entire blockade itself, that's something the United States isn't likely to do so long as Hamas maintains a rocket arsenal and its charter continues to call for military confrontation with Israel. Until those factors change, it'll be very hard for the United States to justify weakening that blockade, both to the Israelis as well as to the still substantial pro-Israel domestic constituency here in the United States.
Blinken's visit to the Middle East is one of five different U.S. delegations that are either in the region or on their way. What do you make of the renewed engagement by the White House in the Middle East?
Well, I think this was something of a rude surprise for the Biden White House. They were not prioritizing the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, in part because there's the grander pivot to Asia that the Biden administration is attempting to do. A lot of diplomatic focus has been on Iran-U.S. talks. And the Palestinian-Israeli conflict doesn't have a clean roadmap to a solution. The Trump administration decided to pivot in the direction of basically being very pro-Israel and believing that would create the leverage over the Palestinians to create a settlement. The Biden administration hasn't put the same kind of emphasis on the conflict. They're re-emphasizing the traditional two-state solution, but it's very hard to see how that goes forward. So the war was a wake-up call for the Biden White House that these conflicts can re-emerge and that they do have some domestic political consequences for the White House. We saw the Democratic Party starting to split along the lines of people who were more pro-Palestinian versus pro-Israeli. And those are complications that the White House doesn't want to see. But they don't really have an easy way to restart negotiations, restart a peace process that would resolve the underlying drivers of this conflict. And they knew that before this war began. They know that now, but they feel politically and diplomatically incentivized and even forced to have to involve themselves into the conflict.
Ryan Bohl is a senior analyst at the intelligence group Stratfor. Thanks a lot, Ryan.
Yeah, thank you.
Uyghur Muslims and other ethnic minorities in far western China are facing an existential threat. The U.S. and several other nations are calling it genocide. Beijing denies that. But what's become increasingly clear, hundreds of thousands of people in the Xinjiang region are living under strict government surveillance. Around a million people are estimated to have been sent to detention camps. For those outside of the camps, daily life means dealing with near constant monitoring, security cameras, facial recognition technology, and smartphone apps. The World's Rebecca Kanther traveled to Xinjiang recently and brings us the first of a two-part series.
Akita Pulat was in grad school in the U.S. when her mother disappeared back home in China. Her mom, Rahila Daoud, is a prominent Uyghur anthropologist at Xinjiang University. She often traveled to the U.S. on academic exchanges. The last time Pulat spoke with Daoud was in 2017, just before her mother was called to a conference in Beijing. She's heard nothing since.
She just disappeared in my life. I called her, no one answering, and I tried to reach out to my dad and my grandparents. They are saying something like, just be patient, your mom might be go back home soon. And later on, I know that my mother is being detained.
Like Rahila Daoud, Hundreds of thousands of Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities have been arbitrarily detained in the past 5 years in Xinjiang for owning a Quran, having WhatsApp on your phone, communicating with relatives abroad. These are all reasons why people have been locked up. China says the detention facilities are vocational training centers meant to re-educate people at risk for religious extremism. But all sorts of people have been targeted, from ordinary folks to scholars, pop stars, models, athletes, and religious leaders. For Chinese authorities, they're all seen as potential security threats. From Shanghai, I fly into Urumqi, the capital of Xinjiang, with two other journalists. The last time I was there was 15 years ago on vacation. This is a very different sort of trip. The surveillance starts while we're still on the plane. We're called off before the other passengers to register with the police. They're polite, take down our details, and ask why we've come. It's the first of many such encounters during our five-day trip.
We just need to show our passports and register.
Even in security-heavy China, the number of cameras, metal detectors, and police checkpoints we see in Xinjiang is jarring. At one highway stop, we're asked the same questions, our passport numbers, where we're going, why we're there, for almost 2 hours. I see that Uyghurs are also stopped and questioned, while Han Chinese people are waved right through. We're followed wherever we go. Sometimes the guys lurking behind trees are comically easy to spot. One wears a giant cowboy hat. We hire a taxi for a 3-hour trip out of town. Our driver is Uyghur, and he's quite friendly. He wears a black t-shirt that reads in English, but first, coffee. His stereo blares Uyghur pop music the whole way. We practice our Uyghur phrases with him.
Okay. 慢慢来,再说一次.
We notice the two surveillance cameras in the car, one in the front, one in the back, so we don't ask a lot of questions. It's impossible for Uyghurs here to talk freely, since they're always being watched. That makes it difficult for a visitor to see the invisible bars they're living behind. Some of the most revealing research into Xinjiang's human rights situation is actually happening outside of China. Nathan Russer is a researcher at Australia Strategic Policy Institute. He uses Google Earth to identify re-education camps, detention centers, and prisons in Xinjiang. Russer's created a database of 380 of these facilities, built or expanded since 2017.
It's really tricky to hide from satellite imagery, and when some of these facilities stretch for as long as 3 kilometers, as the longest one does, that's essentially impossible to hide from the sky.
Chinese authorities now claim they've closed all the camps and released detainees. Russer says the satellite footage he monitors shows that some facilities have indeed been closed in the past year, but it's mostly the ones with lower security.
So you're sort of seeing a shift away from this lower security detention, vocational training, and political indoctrination facilities to sort of more hardcore, high security prisons and detention facilities.
Armed with GPS coordinates, my colleagues and I set out in a car to see for ourselves what one of these detention facilities looks like up close. We drive towards a less developed area on the outskirts of Urumqi. Alongside the road, we can see watchtowers. Then a concrete wall surrounding a set of 5-story buildings. The giant Chinese characters on top of one building read, "Listen to the party." There are definitely people inside. We're so close, we can hear them singing. Just across the road, we see a small group of people flying kites on an open stretch of land. A man who appears to be Han Chinese maneuvers a 2-hand stunt kite, while his wife and baby watch from the back of their van. He introduces himself as Gao Yun. What's that? I ask him, pointing to the hulking complex across the road. It's a detention center, he tells me. Other kite flyers I talk to call it a prison. Less than 10 minutes later, we're surrounded by at least 14 people. A uniformed police officer removes his name tag and warns us that photographing the prison is a breach of national security laws. He examines our passports and other documents while 2 police officers search our cameras and phones. They force us to delete everything. We recovered the files later. The officers interrogate our driver and take down his phone number. After more than an hour of questioning, they let us go. Bye, they call as we drive off. Have a good time.
好, 谢谢你, 谢谢。
A few minutes later, the officers call our driver and ask where we're headed. They follow us back to our hotel. Our experience is typical of other foreign journalists trying to report in Xinjiang. China goes after anyone who tries to expose what's happening, even if they're living outside of the country. Akita Pulat, the young woman in the U.S. whose mother is missing, says she stayed quiet until 2019.
I personally know people who have relatives or friends being detained, but they couldn't speak up like I do because of fear of retaliation from the Chinese government.
For anybody who still has family in the region, speaking up can have a terrible cost to your family members.
Sophie Richardson is a China expert with Human Rights Watch.
That's the whole point. That's precisely the pressure that Chinese authorities are trying to use in keeping people outside the country quiet.
In the case of Akita Pulat, she's still able to call her grandparents in Xinjiang, but says her father has become distant. The UN Human Rights Commission has asked for permission to visit Xinjiang to investigate allegations of abuses. But so far, it has been rebuffed by Beijing. Here's Sophie Richardson again.
The kind of visit that the UN needs to have and the kind of visit the Chinese government is willing to allow are not the same thing, which is why it really is time to gather that evidence outside the country and move ahead.
Richardson says that as China becomes more powerful, its unchecked human rights abuses could have an impact far beyond its borders. What's at stake is not just the rights of Xinjiang's ethnic minorities.
It's also the integrity of the international human rights system. If the most powerful actors can't be held accountable, then I think we've got an even larger problem on our hands.
Uyghurs like Pulat say they just want to see their family members again.
I won't stop my activism until I see my mother's face, see my mother's safely, like, at home.
Human rights advocates say the best way to make that happen is to put more international pressure on China to change its policies in Xinjiang. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther, Urumqi, Xinjiang.
Tomorrow, we'll hear about how Xinjiang became a vacation spot for Chinese travelers.
China has been very, very aggressive in its disinformation campaign, trying to portray a happy look.
China is mourning a revered scientist. Yuan Longping's agricultural breakthroughs helped reduce famine and poverty across much of Asia and Africa. He cultivated strains of rice that produce much higher yields. Until his final days, the scientist kept working to stop hunger, as he said in a speech a few years ago.
This is a very serious challenge facing us, how to feed the world.
How to feed the world. Yuan Longping passed away on Saturday at the age of 91. The World's Patrick Nguyen joins me now. Patrick, Yuan is being hailed as a hero in China and beyond. How did this scientist earn so much admiration?
Yeah, well, Carol, I mean, there aren't that many people who can claim to have saved millions of lives, but I think he can do just that. It really started when he was a young man in China in the 50s and 60s, seeing serious famine, people just turning to skeletons, people eating grass and tree bark. And then he used science to help fix that problem. One of his first big breakthroughs was he found this wild rice species growing by a railroad track. He bred that species with another strain and came up with this new super high-yield species of rice. And the result was basically that a poor farmer with a little plot of land could now produce 30% more rice. And, you know, 30%, that can be the difference between life and death. And I have to point out, like, at the time, scientists not just in China but around the world said that what he was doing was probably impossible, and he proved them wrong. So remember that people used to think of China and think starving masses of people, but no one thinks that anymore, and he's part of the reason why.
What was Yuan Longping's impact outside of China?
It was pretty huge. Mr. Yuan and the Chinese government could have kept these breakthroughs to themselves, but he really didn't have that type of vision. I actually spoke with one of his colleagues, a guy named Jawahar Ali, with the International Rice Research Institute, and he said Yuan cared about everyone, not just people in his own country.
This technology saved not only China, but also the world. His vision, actually, was to feed the world.
Right. So Mr. Yuan, he pushed to spread this high-yield rice everywhere he could, and he kept improving upon different strains throughout his life. You know, for half the people on Earth, rice is their main staple. And he helped bring these high-yield strains of rice to Nigeria, Pakistan, Vietnam, India. Actually, some of it is growing right now in America, too. And I have to say, the most recent rice species he was working on was this rice that grows in really salty soil near the coast, places that have been seen as barren. I mean, this man was 90 and still working on this stuff, so he really achieved a lot. And even though his name wasn't really well-known outside of China, there are people walking around right now in parts of India and parts of Africa who would not be alive if it weren't for him.
It's an incredible story. How is China memorializing him?
It's a big deal in China. On social media, you see people crying, calling him Grandpa Yuan. You can see clips of big crowds carrying flowers and chasing after his black hearse as it left the hospital. People were chanting things like, "Farewell, Grandpa." You can hear their footsteps running after the hearse. You know, in China, hunger is not some remote concept to people. It's something Grandma and Grandpa remember very well in the 1960s. They remember famine. That's why Yuan received very high honors in China. In fact, it seems like it's illegal to criticize him in China. A few people on social media said some snarky things after his death and got detained. But overall, he really was worthy of accolades. The United Nations is now calling Yuan a true food hero. And his colleague, Mr. Ali, who I talked to today, he told me that Yuan actually, in private, was a really good guy. He would mentor just about anyone who asked, regardless of their national background. He traveled around Africa and Asia to spread his ideas. So you can find people mourning his death, not just in China, but in countries all the way from the Philippines to Mozambique.
The World's Patrick Nguyen. Thanks so much, Patrick.
Thanks, Carol.
Tragedy in China this weekend. 21 people died after extreme weather struck an ultra-marathon event in a northwestern province. Runners faced hail, high winds, and freezing temperatures. The World's Bianca Hillier has the details.
Weather conditions got drastically worse just a few hours after the 172 participants took off on Saturday morning. Photos show runners huddling under foil blankets. Local media reports that a half dozen athletes sheltered in a cave and posted videos requesting help in a group chat. By 2 p.m., the race was called off.
Ultra events, I mean, it requires just so much more safety measures because you are in these remote places.
Janet Ng is an ultramarathon race director in Hong Kong. She was not involved in this weekend's 62-mile race, but she says for races like this, organizers typically closely monitor weather conditions leading up to and during the event. The AP reports the local weather center had warned for the past 3 days of hail and strong winds. Beijing City authorities, who organized the race, apologized in a press conference yesterday.
This was a public safety incident caused by a sudden weather change. As the organizers of the marathon race, we feel a deep sense of guilt and responsibility. We express our deep condolences to the victims and our deep sympathy to the bereaved families and those who were injured.
Liang Jing was one of those lost to the storm. He was an elite Chinese runner who had won this race 3 times before. Through a translator, Jing told media about his love of the sport in 2019.
One of the things I hear about you is that you race all the time, maybe every weekend. Is that true?
You feel happy when he's running, so that's why every weekend there's always a race, or even maybe two.
Jing will be sorely missed by the running community, says race director Janet Ng.
We got to know him through the years, and he is one of the best ultra-running endurance athletes in the world.
She says despite his success, Jing was a humble champion.
Very, very down to earth, and there's just no ego in him. He's just such an honest and very special athlete.
Liang Jing is survived by his wife and 3-year-old daughter. According to Chinese media, hundreds of rescuers searched for missing runners through the night on Saturday. All participants have now been accounted for. 21 people died, and 8 were hospitalized with minor injuries. Seasoned marathoners and race organizers have voiced concerns over the lack of emergency plans at the event. Authorities in the province have now formed a team to investigate whether or not the tragedy could have been prevented. For the World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The Pacific Island nation of Samoa was set to swear in its first ever female prime minister today, but things did not go as planned. It started when the newly elected ruling party showed up to the parliament building this morning in the capital Apia to find it locked. Reporter Ashley Westerman joins us to tell us what's going on. She's in Manila. Ashley, this was supposed to be an historic day for Samoa. Who is the woman who's supposed to be Samoa's first female prime minister?
Yes, so her name is Fiamme Nuome Maataafa, and she's the leader of the party that was supposed to form Samoa's new government. It's a party that came about last year, and it's known as FAST. Fiamme hails from a political and cultural dynasty. Her father is a paramount chief and was the first prime minister of Samoa, and her mother is a well-known pro-woman figure in the country. Now, Fiamme herself has had a storied political career and has broken barriers before. She was the country's first female deputy prime minister and the first woman to hold a ministerial position. Samoan independent journalist Lagi Poiva Sherelle Jackson says that culturally and politically, Fiamme holds a lot of influence.
And the fact that she is a woman who has, you know, attained this level of leadership in government it's a huge milestone for Samoa.
So this all sounds positive.
Yeah, but while Fiamme is very pro-woman, Samoa is still firmly ruled culturally by men. Here's Sherelle Jackson again.
I think the biggest challenge ahead is how accepting will the rest of the MPs be to the fact that they will be led by a woman.
Fiamme's party shocked everyone by pulling out a victory over the longtime ruling Human Rights Protection Party. And they've been in power since 1982. So this was a big deal. And if she's ever officially sworn in, Fiamme will only be the second woman to lead a Pacific Island nation.
So what happened when she showed up this morning to be sworn in?
Well, basically, she and her party were locked out. There were even police present. FAST ended up holding a swearing ceremony anyway, in a big white tent outside. And Fiamme was sworn in as the new prime minister, and she named her cabinet. But it's actually unclear what that ceremony meant, if anything. And today just wasn't the same for those who were really hoping for this historical moment. Here's Siatu Alifeo. She's a sociology professor at Massey University in New Zealand. She's Samoan and was watching the ceremony via Facebook Live.
I really wish I could watch it, you know, in a place of joy and in happiness. The possibility of Samoa's first woman prime minister. So today was meant to be that possibility becoming the reality.
So Ashley, how did we get to this point?
Well, there's been a lot of legal tumult, including a call for a do-over of the election on a political technicality. But that bid was quashed last week by the Samoan Supreme Court. And then over just this past weekend, the outgoing prime minister, Tu'i La'epa Salele Malele Ga'oi, convinced the head of state to suspend the convening of the new parliament on Monday. And then on Sunday, just yesterday, the Supreme Court overruled that and said the new parliament could convene, which is why an ad hoc ceremony was held.
So what happens next?
Well, after the outdoor swearing-in ceremony, the outgoing prime minister accused the FAST party of staging a coup. The country's attorney general also released a statement saying the gathering was unlawful. But meanwhile, the new government is being congratulated, and other countries, such as Micronesia, are showing their support for Fiamme's new government. So this really isn't settled yet. The people who supported Fiamme and FAST were hoping to usher in a new era of governance with a party that wants to, you know, prioritize women, make it easier for Samoan diaspora to vote, and implement things like term limits. But according to Samoa's constitution, Monday was the last day parliament could be convened, so no one really knows what's going to happen next.
So can the new prime minister, Fiamme, go to work tomorrow morning or not?
That is unclear at this point. This is uncharted territory for Samoa, and no one is quite sure what is going to happen on Tuesday.
Reporter Ashley Westerman joining us from the Philippines. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's where we leave things off on this Monday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carol Hills, back with more stories from around the globe tomorrow.